On this week's episode of Video Culture, we'll talk sneaky surveillance movies with The Conversation and Sneakers.
Did you rewind it?
I don't know.
In a time where everyone has a podcast, in a place where everyone has an opinion, two heroes, Matthew and Ryan, against all odds, are here to save your movie viewing experience from total disaster. Your trip through the video aisles of yesteryear begins now. There will be chills. There will be thrills. And there's a good chance that Ryan will have a coffee spill. They'll discuss the quality, cultural significance, and more detail, frankly, than you bargained for. Here's your host, Ryan Acree and Matthew Essery.
And welcome to another episode of Video Culture. I'm your host, Ryan Acree.
And I'm Matthew Essery.
And man, oh man, it has been a wonderful 2 weeks. We have once again watched another two fantastic movies. I love watching these movies. Yeah. We have one old movie and one kind of a little bit newer movie. Yeah.
They're made about 20 years apart. And I just want to say, you know, you mentioned these two, they're fantastic. We often say that these movies are good or interesting or great.
Yeah.
But no, these two movies are literally great.
Well, I mean, I got to do my announcer thing and like sell these movies, you know, like these two fantastic movies. Because I think it's fun to watch any of these movies, even if they're maybe two-star movies.
Yeah.
I think it's still extremely interesting and fun to go back and watch all of them.
What I'm trying to say today, my friend, is that these are two fantastic movies.
Well, one of them was directed by Francis Ford Coppola, and one stars a extremely all-star cast, including Robert Redford,
Sidney Poitier, Dan Aykroyd, River Phoenix,
James Earl Jones,
yeah.
And the other one, I mean, the cast isn't bad. I mean, you have Gene Hackman. Robert Duvall.
Harrison Ford. Yeah.
From the 70s.
Yeah, when he was all young and cool.
So let's get into it. So, yeah, we'll mention The Conversation and Sneakers. So the first movie that we'll talk about is we'll have a conversation about The Conversation.
An excellent film from 1974, again, by the aforementioned Francis Ford Coppola.
Now, this was made right after The Godfather.
Godfather.
So I'll go ahead and give you a little bit of a note now, is that he had this idea for this movie, for this kind of like surveillance type movie. Gene Hackman is the main star. He plays Harry Caul, C-A-U-L, and he's kind of a private eye, but just to record people's private conversations.
He's a securities expert, specializing in surveillance.
So, and this is, like I said, the film is set for the time period around 1974, but Francis Ford Coppola got the idea back in the mid-60s. Now, he couldn't get financing for it, but lo and behold, The Godfather, like, exploded. Made
all the money back then.
Broke tons of box office records at the time. He had the financing to make his own, went into his own, like, kind of company to make this movie, The Conversation. And he also made this alongside, at the same time, made The Godfather Part Two.
Yeah. So these came out the same year.
The same year.
You think if any other director ever had two movies that were as good as those two movies in the same year?
Especially, I mean, The Godfather Part Two.
Yeah.
Right. So to me, I mean, just the seriousness of Gene Hackman and Francis Ford Coppola, it's an amazing, amazing, amazing film.
Yeah. And this really is Gene Hackman at the height of his powers. I mean, Gene Hackman is one of our greatest living actors, and he's retired now, unfortunately.
Right.
But at the time, he was probably in his early 40s.
Right.
And he's amazing. He is so believable and empathetic, and he's a force. So he's got so much screen charisma.
Right.
Like, for such an average-looking guy, you just can't take your eyes off of him.
No, okay? He plays this really sort of kind of a nerdy, scientific, like, kind of a fuddy-duddy type of character where, the film opens up, and it's, San Francisco, and they are surveilling, they're recording a conversation between a man and a woman walking around Union Square in San Francisco. And if you've ever been to Union Square in San Francisco, like I have, you know that it's a very big place.
You've
it's
actually been there.
Very noisy place. Yes, I did. I went there on my honeymoon back in 2007.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And, yeah, there's lots of downtown buildings. There's, you know, cars driving by, like honking their horns. There's street performers. I mean, it's a place where if you work downtown and you just wanted to go somewhere to just, like, you know, chill for a little bit, maybe sit down and eat your lunch, you know, that sort of thing.
That's where you do it.
Yeah, that's where you would go.
And basically, yeah, the film opens with him doing surveillance on this couple, and the couple's walking around, and at first the sound of the film sounds a little distorted. Like, when I first played this film, I thought the copy I had rented was faulty. Like, I restarted my player, and because I thought something was wrong with the audio. But what they do is pretty inventive. As they open the film and they show them recording the couple, they actually give you the idea of what the sound sounds like to them as they're recording. So the sound starts off kind of bad, but as they pick up other sources in their surveillance, the audio gets clearer and clearer as the scene goes on.
Now, let me tell you a personal story about this.
Okay.
A friend of mine, he has a copy of this movie, and he knows that I'm an audio guy. Mm-hmm. And he was like, you have to watch his movie. So he gave me his, or he lent me, I don't own it. He lent me a copy on Laserdisc. So one day, even before we started doing the podcast and knowing that this is going to be one of the movies that we were going to talk about, go to put the Laserdisc in. And the sound has this really kind of like repetitive things going on. And then I hear the noises that you're talking about.
Sounds like audio distortion.
And I was like, the audio is like really messed up because it's a really long intro.
Yes.
There's like, you know, not really music playing in the background. I mean, you're really just kind of watching the scene unfold.
It's all ambient noise. It feels like you're just watching a scene being recorded.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and you see people following. You see Gene Hackman, and he kind of makes his way towards the surveillance van. And I was just like, but by the time him and the other guy in the van start having, you know, an actual conversation in the van, I was like, this sound is really off.
Yeah.
And that's when I realized that, like, laser rot. This is what has happened to this copy. So
the bane of a lot of home video collectors, laser rot.
Laser disc, yeah.
Which is where, if you listen to our home video episode, we talked about how sometimes these discs, the glue in them, can degrade over time, and the disc can basically separate and be unplayable.
Right. And the video was kind of there, but the video, unfortunately, this video was made to where there's no digital track. It's just the analog track that's embedded, and kind of got lost in translation there. So, unfortunately, bad copy, but eventually it is available, I think, right now on Amazon Prime.
That's where I watched it.
So
at this moment of this recording, it may not be in however many months before this comes out, but at this time, it is free on Amazon Prime.
All right.
So, of course, it's highly recommended.
Yeah. So, continuing on, it does look like it was shot, like, on 16mm.
Yeah, it's very gritty.
Yeah, it is very gritty. And it is the 70s sort of like grit. It's a very sort of long movie. It's almost like 2 hours, I think.
It's right under 2 hours. It's about an hour 56.
Right.
And the movie, there's not a lot of different cast members in the film. It's mostly the Gene Hackman show.
Right. And like I mentioned before, written, directed, produced by Francis Ford Coppola. The production company was the Directors Company, which was a company that was founded by Francis Ford Coppola, Peter Bogdanovich, and William Friedkin.
Of Sorcerer and The Exorcist.
Yeah. So it was a very short-lived production company. They only released 3 movies. This is one of them. So you have Gene Hackman. You have Alan Garfield.
Alan Garfield, yeah.
Who was also in Beverly Hills Cop 2.
He was.
As the...
He's a video culture alumnist, yeah.
Yeah, he was... I knew I'd seen him before. I was like, I've seen that guy before. And I look up his filmography, I'm like, oh yeah, he was the police chief and Beverly Hills Cop 2. A very young Terry Garr.
Yes, a very young Terry Garr.
Yeah, she kind of plays... I couldn't tell. Okay, so in the movie, the surveillance will tell about the plot of the movie, is that he hears this conversation, he mixes it down, and then in one of the lines, he kind of has to filter out, and he filters that, you know, he's going to, or he might kill us.
Yeah, the couple, the girl and the couple, played by Terry Garr, says the phrase, he's going to kill us if he finds out.
Right.
No, you know, it was, he would kill us if he had the chance.
He would kill us if he had the chance. So, and he had to do a lot of, like, filtering to figure this out.
Yeah.
He had to, one of his little boxes, and he goes to, like, plugs up and, like, does the filter and does the frequencies. And then finally, because he has a mask out, the, you know, these musicians that are playing like right over top of them.
And it seems very accurate for the time period for how sound mixing was done. And it's almost a little technical in its, in what you're watching, but it's pretty fascinating to watch.
Right.
You know, tweaking the dials, flipping switches. It's really quite interesting to see.
Right. And I mean, I worked in a radio station. I can tell you, I've seen equipment like that. Reel-to-reel tape machines, micro. I mean, that's how it was done, like, back in the 70s. I mean, yeah. That's how audio surveillance was kind of done.
Yeah.
Also, but, like, I couldn't. So, but he's a real fuddy-duddy. He doesn't want anybody to know anything about him.
Yeah, he's super paranoid because of what he does.
Right.
He's always assuming someone's going to find out about him or spy on him. So when you're first introduced to him after the surveillance scene in the beginning, they show him going to his apartment, and he's got multiple locks on his door. He's got alarms set on his door.
Yeah.
When he finds out someone's been in his apartment, and it was just his landlady dropping off mail, he immediately calls and be like, and it's like, don't come into my apartment again. Why do you have a key?
Right.
No one should have a key but me.
Right.
You know, so I'm just a very paranoid, cautious person.
Right. And you kind of watch the whole movie kind of as a voyeur yourself. Kind of over Harry Call's shoulder, yeah. Kind of like. And yeah. You're just kind of following him along like a fly on the wall, really.
Yeah, I mean, you do get to see some dream sequences of his, but for the most part, you're kind of an observer in the room.
Right.
You know, you're not really in his perspective at all.
Mm-hmm.
You're just kind of watching these things happen to him.
Right.
And
But you don't really know a lot about him.
You don't know anything about him,
no.
Really.
And then you just kind of find out more and more through the conversations that he has with other people.
Yes.
And then you know that he wants to drop off this tape to, you know, this guy, Robert Duvall, the director.
Yeah. Well, he wants to drop it off to the man who ordered it from his company. Yeah,
right.
He doesn't know anything about him. He just knows right. That he's supposed to meet this man at this time. And he goes to try to meet the man, and he's not there. So right. He's like, well, I'm just going to leave. Let me know when he's there, and I'll come back.
Right.
And his assistant's there, played by a very young, very dashing Harrison Ford.
Yes. Now, this was in between American Graffiti and Star Wars.
Yes.
Because he was in American Graffiti, and then there was just like a – that was like 1972, and then he did some like Gunsmoke and yeah. A couple other TV shows, and then he does this –
Star Wars isn't until 3 years later.
Yeah, like 76 seven, or 77. Yeah, well, they filmed in 76.
It would have been 2 years at
yeah,
the most.
Right, yeah. Exactly. So, but I mean, he really didn't do a lot. So this is the one movie that he just did TV shows, you know, it was like another, you know, person, gunman or whatever, that gets shot in Gunsmoke. But, I mean, this was the other movie that he was in.
And he basically tries to get the tape from Harry, and Harry's like, no. That was not our agreement. I'll give it to your boss when your boss is available. And Harrison Ford's character doesn't like that. Mm-hmm. And it kind of triggers Harry's paranoia.
Right.
You know? So he kind of ramps up his isolation, his looking over his shoulder. And when he's still worrying about this idea about what the couple said about if he had the chance to kill us, he will.
Right.
Because Harry had done surveillance for other agencies, other companies. And one of the people he did surveillance on ended up getting murdered.
Right.
And he thinks it might have been his client who did it based on the surveillance he did. Yeah. So he's got a lot of guilt about that.
Well, you don't find that out until he goes to this convention.
Yes.
He meets up with some of his other, you know, comrades or colleagues,
yeah,
kind
his
of
surveillance,
yeah, his surveillance
buddies,
the other guys that are in the same, you know, same field as Harry. And then, you know, the guy, like, he used to, you find out. that this other guy, Moran, which is played by Alan Garfield, Bernie Moran is the character name, you know, spills the beans and tells everybody at this party that they're having, like, after the convention, that, yeah, Harry used to be in New York. He used to be the number one guy, and he basically got this Teamster guy, you know, killed. And it was between the, you know, the Teamster Union president and this other guy. And the only way, the only time they ever talked about it was on a boat, you know, in the middle of this lake with nobody around.
They were super careful.
Right. Yeah. Super careful. And then, but like somehow Harry got a recording of it and he kept trying to get him to, you know, give him the secrets to divulge the secrets of how he did it.
How'd you do it, Harry?
How'd you do it? But he didn't want to talk about it because it's like, he knows that that guy wound up getting killed.
Yeah, and he's very Catholic. Francis Ford Coppola is a very religious director. Mm-hmm. Coppola is fascinated with Catholic imagery, Catholic themes, and Catholic guilt. That's a big part of the Catholic religion. And Harry Call carries that guilt of that man's death with him throughout the entire film. And when he thinks this other couple might be in danger because of his work, that guilt kind of comes back to haunt him. And that's kind of the movie, is how he deals with his paranoia and his guilt and his wanting to do the right thing and be a good person, but also being afraid to put himself out there because putting himself at risk.
Yeah, like when he goes to deliver the tapes the first time
and
then leaves, he sees the girl that, you know, that he was recording, like, in the elevator. And he gets just, like, extremely scared and, you know.
He realizes that they're someone directly related to the people he's doing the surveillance for.
Now, I don't know if you noticed, that was played by, the woman was played by Cindy Williams, who some people might know, Cindy Williams, from Laverne and Shirley.
That's true, yeah.
So, anyway, I just thought I would throw it. And who was also in American Graffiti with Harrison Ford.
Yeah.
Oh, anyway.
That's cool, man. Yeah.
We'll have more facts later.
And also, I got to mention, Harry has an assistant who's in quite a bit of the film, played by John Cazale.
Right.
John Cazale, he plays Fredo in the Godfather trilogy.
Yeah.
Or in the first two Godfather films. Yes. He's not in Godfather 3.
Yes, he is.
Is he?
Yes.
It's been a long day, guys. Thank you for bringing me. Yeah,
He was only in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. He was only in 6 movies.
Yes.
Well, he was in 1 short film, which doesn't really count.
But every feature-length film he was ever in, fascinating bit of trivia about him, he ended up passing away. He got very sick and passed away at a very young age. But every film he was in was nominated for Best Picture.
All right, so quickly go through the list.
Let's see. Godfather 1, Godfather 2, Dog Day Afternoon, The Conversation, The Deer Hunter.
Yep.
And that's it. I mean, I don't know.
Godfather Part 3.
Was he in Godfather Part 3?
Yeah.
Like I said, it's been a
long
day.
According to my filmography.
I'm going to let you guys know something. Like a lot of film fans, I hate Godfather Part 3.
Okay.
Godfather Part 3 is terrible.
All right.
I've seen it once.
All right. Well, we're moving on.
We're not going to get into that.
That's the Godfather Part 3.
Yeah.
As far as the conversation goes.
Yeah.
So we have to talk about the ending.
How much do you want to get into the spoilers of the ending?
I would say this, the ending is not an ending that will leave you with great resolve.
Yes.
It's one of those endings, I think, that makes you think about, you know, you have to self-reflect and decide for yourself, you know, what the actual, like, you know, ending is.
Yeah. Even kind of what the moral message of the ending is.
Right.
So I'm going to say something we've never really done before. I'm going to encourage you, if you have not seen The Conversation, please stop the podcast and go watch it before you can listen to the rest of this.
Right. If you had not seen the ending, because we have to talk about the ending. Yes.
But there's so much of the joy in the movie is how the movie unfolds at the end.
If you know the ending, it's one of those movies that everything happens and then at the end, like, things change and then, like, they kind of turn around and you're like,
it causes you to rethink about everything you've seen before.
Yeah, and you're like, so, what just happened?
Well, last chance. If you haven't seen it yet, please pause the podcast. We'll be here when you get back, I promise.
Right.
Pause it. Go to Amazon Prime and rent it. It's worth your 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to go 1, 2, 3. Let's talk about the ending.
So we find out that... You know,
but basically, in the
you started. I can't even begin to explain.
Basically, Harry eventually takes the tape to the guy who actually requested them.
Right.
And you find out
who was played by Robert Duvall.
Played by Robert Duvall in a very small part.
Yep.
And you find out the girl on the tape is somehow connected with him. It's implied that it's his girlfriend or his wife. Because you see photos of them together. They look very happy.
That's the idea.
And Robert Duvall seems very upset when he hears the tapes.
Right. So you kind of get the idea, like Harry does, that like these two people are in some sort of affair together. And the director, you know, he sees, you know, later he sees pictures of the director and this girl on his desk. Like they're together, like they're a couple. But he knows that he saw her with the other guy in the square.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, if he finds out, they're going to kill us, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so he is guilty thinking these people are going to get killed. Now he thinks, okay, now I know why they're going to get killed, because they're cheating on this very powerful man. Mm-hmm. And on the tape, they mention getting together on Sunday at a particular hotel in a particular hotel room.
Right.
So Harry goes there that day, gets the room next to the room.
Well, wait a second. You forgot about a whole other part. He wasn't going to deliver the tapes. He made a decision that he wasn't going to deliver them.
That's right. They stole the tape from him.
So that night, after the party, he goes to sleep with you know, one of the girls from the party, who they hired to kind of be like the, you know, showgirl for the event.
Yeah.
And he wakes up. She's gone. The tapes are gone.
Yeah. And he goes to the office to meet the director, but still they pay him. They're like, you still did your job.
No, he gets a call and says, you know, from Harrison Ford's character. He actually has a name. Martin Stett.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Martin Stett, yeah.
So Martin calls him and says, yeah, we have your tapes. It's okay. So we didn't think that you were going to deliver them, so we had to, you know, do what we had to do.
Yeah.
You'll still get paid. And so he's like... So that's when he goes down to the office.
And that's when he sees the photos of them together, and he starts piecing together what he decides to do at the end. So, yeah, he goes to the hotel when this couple is supposed to meet, thinking he's going to warn them, like, you have to go. They know you're going to be meeting up at this hotel. So he goes into he rents the room next to that room and places surveillance bugs.
Mm-hmm.
And he's trying to listen in.
Kind of drill through the wall.
Yeah.
Trying to listen in on the conversation.
And as he's doing this, he's getting more and more paranoid, more and more guilty throughout the build-up to this.
Well, he can hear people yelling. He can hear the director, like, yelling. He can hear, you know, Anne, the girl, yelling.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, my gosh, this is, you know.
Yeah. And at one point, he steps outside to try to look around the balcony, and he sees... And you don't know if it's a hallucination or if it's actually happening. He's like, suddenly a bloody handprint pops up on the glass between the two balconies.
Yeah, because it's like frosted glass in between them.
Like
in
the 70s, you know, it was a frosted glass, but they were everywhere in the 70s. It's a real good jump scare, but you don't know if it's real or not. Because at that point, Harry darts back into the room and basically hides for probably several hours.
Right. And you don't know how much long time has passed. You know that it was daylight. That it was out, and it was like 4 o'clock where they were supposed to meet on Sunday afternoon. And then all of a sudden it's like nighttime.
Yeah.
And it's like really dark. And so, and then all of a sudden he's like laying on his bed with the TV on, like kind of almost in a fetal position. And then just decides that he's going to get up and like go next door, pick the lock. He has to know what happened. He's going to pick the lock and, you know, see if he can figure out what happened, see if he can find any evidence. And it's just like, you know, to me, I start thinking, like, why would you put yourself in that situation? Because you might accidentally leave, you know, a hair or a fingerprint or something like that.
You also worry, what kind of messed up thing is he going to find?
Yeah,
exactly. Is he going to find, like, bodies or grisly, like, carnage? Right.
Yeah.
And he opens a hotel room, and it's pristine.
It's spotless. I mean, even checks the bathroom and checks in the tub.
Like it's got the paper over the toilet, like it had been cleaned and verified. It's got, like the security tape over it. Everything looks nice. So he's looking through the hotel room, looking for anything, and it's perfectly quiet. It's so quiet. All you hear is a little bit of ambient noise of him just shuffling around the room.
Yeah,
you hear water dripping in the sink and the toilet running. That's how quiet
it is. So you're just expecting, and especially since you had that previous jump scare, you're just expecting
something. Like waiting like a boogeyman to like leap out at him.
Right.
And he's looking around and he doesn't find anything. Like he's reaching under like the faucet in the bathtub, and nothing. And he's getting ready to leave, and he's like hearing the sound of the toilet running. And by that point, it's the only sound you're hearing.
Mm-hmm.
And so finally, he lifts the toilet up, and it's fine. But he jiggles it. Nothing happens, but it's still making the running sound. He jiggles it again, and suddenly, a bloom of red liquid comes up from inside the toilet bowl.
Right.
And it just suddenly fills with blood that overflows from the toilet.
Yeah.
And, like, bloody tissues are coming up out of it, too.
Yeah.
And it basically comes up out of the toilet, spills all over the floor. It's actually like the shot in The Shining,
yeah,
where the elevator doors open.
Mm-hmm.
It's very stylistically similar to that.
Yeah.
And then it cuts to him charging into the guy's, trying to charge into the guy's office, being like, "What did you do? What did you do?"
Yeah.
And he gets stopped by security,
right,
and thrown out,
right.
And as he's on the street, he sees the director's car.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes and looks to see if he can see him in there, but the director's not in the car. It's the girl,
right?
And she doesn't seem that concerned, or like she's been, pardon all, she's casually reading mm-hmm. a magazine.
Yep.
And then he starts to think, "Oh no, it wasn't them at all that were in danger. It wasn't the couple at all."
Yeah.
And he's thinking back on what he heard and what he thought he heard.
Right.
And what he realizes was they weren't planning to meet up. They were planning to basically surprise her boyfriend, her husband, the director, and kill him.
Yeah.
So Robert Duvall's character goes to confront them, thinking he's going to catch them in, like, these two lovebirds. And, like, her secret boyfriend's waiting with, like, a plastic tarp, and they murder him.
And it's almost like a flashback kind of scene.
Yeah.
Because there was, like, a newspaper article where it says the director of this, like, company died, or whatever.
Yeah, he sees a newspaper then, where he's putting it all together.
Right, and there's just all these flashbacks of, like, how everything transpired in the hotel room that you couldn't see that Harry was trying to hear, where the director comes in, the boyfriend and, you know, take him, but the boyfriend has to do the work, so she goes to the balcony. He does the, like, stabbing or killing or whatever, but, like, he's trying to get to her. So that's what the bloody hand came from. Yeah. It was actually the director's hand trying to get to her.
And
that's why there was a scream, because she was just like, "Oh my gosh." So it was really her scream, but it was like his bloody hands. And then you see him, like, on the bed covered in plastic. I mean, it was all, like, really weird. And it's just like, now he kind of knows, he kind of figures out, like, what happened.
Yeah.
And then it's like, what do you do with this information? So he's just at home. The final scene, he's just at home playing his saxophone like he did earlier in the movie.
That's the one way he relaxes by playing jazz music to
just records. And then the phone rings. He picks up the phone and it's nothing. Hangs up. Goes back to playing. Then the phone rings again. He picks it up and it's Martin. Martin Stead again. And I was like, you know,
we know, you know.
Yeah, we know, you know. And we trust that you will not, you know, say anything or something like that. And then they play the recording of him playing sax in the room.
Just a few minutes earlier.
Yeah, and he's just
implying that they can hear what he's doing.
That's right.
And Harry hangs up the phone.
So basically he knows at that point that he is bugged.
So in some way that he's been bugged. And then it cuts to Harry very quietly, again, very still, searching his apartment for where the bug might be meticulously. And the last, 10 minutes of the movie is literally Harry tearing apart his apartment.
He's tearing apart different things. He tears apart his phone. He tears apart all these different stuff.
He's pulling the floorboards.
He finally gets down to, like, his room is, like, empty. I mean, he's tore up his couches. He's turned tables. And, I mean, he said previously in the thing when he was talking to the lady that, like, nothing's in here personal. Like, it can all, like, go away. I don't really care if everything gets stolen. Like, whatever. It's all replaceable stuff or whatever. But he finally gets down to, like, his Madonna. And he's like...
His Virgin Mary statue.
Yeah, his Virgin Mary statue. And he's like... And then finally, he's just like, "I gotta find out." Yeah. Breaks the Virgin Mary.
And, he's so consumed with his fear and paranoia that he even kind of forsakes his Catholic, upbringing.
And it's still not in there. Then he starts tearing apart the floorboards because he's just like, he's so consumed and so much in fear at this point. He's like, "I still haven't found the thing that I need to find." And then, you cut to the final scene. It's like, once again, it's like dark. So you know that, like, multiple hours have passed, and like he's torn up every like his whole floor, so it's just subfloor in his whole apartment.
His walls are bare, like dead down to like the drywall.
Yeah, and he's down in the corner of his apartment, just sitting there on the subfloor,
playing his
saxophone.
Like he's given up. He's like he's given up. He's been broken by the situation.
Right. So here's the thing. Here's the thing that I think is like most telling. What do you think was the real ending of the movie? Like, was he bugged? Was he not? Like, what?
I think that he was. I think there are ways they could have bugged him.
Okay.
But I think the point is the fact that when you try to live your life that kind of paranoid state all the time, it's not sustainable. It will end up consuming you.
Mm-hmm.
You can't be that wary of your fellow man 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It'll just eat you up. You can't isolate yourself that much. Because really the whole movie in a lot of ways is about isolation.
Right, because he even tried to, Terry Garr's like girlfriend, Amy, I mean, he tried to like tell her as little as possible to try to keep her safe because he didn't want to let everybody know. But eventually she got bored and she's like, I got to know who you are. You know, you got to let me in somehow. And he just was uncomfortable with that. He cut her out. The same thing with the guy that he was working with. You know, the guy wanted to know a little bit about him. He's like,
just tell me a little about your life and a little about what you do. Teach me the trade a little more.
Right.
And he just was so unwilling to let anyone in that he had no one to rely on because he couldn't trust anyone. And when you don't have anyone to trust, eventually you're going to be alone in ruin.
Right.
And that's kind of what he was. He was alone in the ruins of his life.
I'll tell you what kind of I think. I don't think that here's the thing, whether he was actually bugged or not, whether it was in his head or not, I think that's the biggest question. Was there an actual bug? Was there actual not a bug? To me, I don't think it really matters because think just like you, I think it's more of an introspection towards like the choices that you make and the type of work that you're in is just that you're going to come to expect that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I think that, you're going to tear yourself apart and make yourself crazy, basically. Like no rational person would do that kind of thing, if you weren't driven to do that kind of thing. Yeah. So, because he was already getting sort of mad, like kind of before that. So it's just like, how much of what he does, like, you know, gets to you. Like before in the movie, you know, the guy Moran says, oh, you just do a trick and then you go on. You don't think about what you do. And like, he couldn't let himself do that. He had to think about, he had to have a conscience. And he's like, if I have a conscience where I have to, you know, go and, you know, to my, you know, give my sins and go to confession, then, you know, that's the kind of price that he has to pay basically for that.
Well, it was also the fact that he isolated himself. Like everyone else in the movie had connections. They had people who they could talk to and be around. And he had no one. He didn't let himself have anything because of his fear and paranoia. And again, that left him with no one to turn to for solace at the end. Mm. Which is why I think it's fun to watch this with Sneakers. Because Sneakers, in a lot of ways, and just to jump over to that, talk about themes. Sneakers is kind of in a lovely way about friendship and relying on your friends and your buddies to help you get through a tough situation. Right.
The last thing that I'll say before we start talking about Sneakers is that the other fan theories was the bug was in his glasses. Mm-hmm. Because at one point, when he's with the girl at the end of the party, she takes his glasses off before they get into bed. And the idea is that like she swapped out his glasses before the end of the night. Like, she took his tapes. She's very capable, doing whatever.
Yeah, and the movie's very meticulous. So, yeah. I mean, there's very little in that movie that feels unnecessary and unimportant.
Yeah, or the bug was in a strap. Or the bug, this is the other biggest fan theory, is that the bug was in the saxophone itself.
And that's the one thing he couldn't bring himself to destroy.
Because that was the one thing that did bring him solace.
Yeah.
And so if it was in the saxophone, that means that he would have to destroy the only thing, his only connection to solace.
The only thing he cared about.
He couldn't bring himself to do that. Yeah. He could do it with the Virgin Mary, because he knew that that was just like a symbol and he could replace it. But the saxophone, he felt like too connected to destroy. So yeah, that's what I think.
Yes. An amazing film that really is, again, it's to me, it's all about the cost of loneliness and paranoia.
Right.
And but just a wonderful thriller.
Right, right, right.
Wonderful, wonderful thriller.
Yeah. But yeah, it is a little bit like Rearview Mirror, like the viewed gets to be, the viewer gets to be the viewed kind of thing. Yeah.
And it's, your perspective changes as you learn more about the story. It's wonderfully directed by Coppola. It's such a interesting movie. And Hackman is amazing in this film. Yeah. He's next level. I mean, you realize what a great actor he is from watching this. If you've only seen Gene Hackman like in the Superman films or like The Quick and the Dead or that terrible movie he made when he retired with Ray Romano called Welcome to Mooseport,
mm-hmm.
you really wouldn't realize how great Gene Hackman is.
Yeah, I thought I'd seen Hackman movies, but it's like when you go back, it's kind of like Burt Reynolds, you know, kind of thing. It's like, you see their early work, and you're like, oh my gosh, he's a completely different person.
That's why they were movie stars. Like, that's why they were considered big deals.
Yeah.
And it's revelatory. You're like, oh my God. Yeah. And Gene Hackman, of course, had made great movies, but he has never been better than he is in The Conversation.
Well, I've always had a theory that, like, actors that have a life, you know, near the end of their careers, they just wind up playing themselves.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It almost falls into parody a little bit. But in the 70s, he was at the height of his powers again and just, phenomenal. Like, Chef's Kiss, just an amazing performance.
Right. So, let's move on to Sneakers. This was 1992. It was directed by Phil Alden Robinson, who also directed Field of Dreams, The Sum of All Fears, and the Band of Brothers HBO series. Yeah. It was produced by Lawrence Laser and Walter F. Parks, which not a lot of people know, but some people know Lawrence. Both of them worked on War Games, Project X, and Awakenings. But Parks, oh my God, this guy has produced some amazing movies.
It's true.
I know you know who he is. I had to find out who he was.
We'll let the listeners know.
Holy crap. I'm only going to listen. Like, I couldn't even list the whole list. I encourage you to go to the Wikipedia page, look up Walter F. Parks, P-A-R-K-E-S, Men in Black, Amistad, Deep Impact, Gladiator, AI, Minority Report, The Ring. I mean, but that's only like the small nugget. I mean, the list is like gigantuan. I can't even tell you how big it is, how many movies that guy has produced.
He had a real eye for quality.
He knows how to get around. But the thing is, both of these guys, Lawrence Laser and Walter F. Parks, worked on War Games. And that's an important aspect, I think, of this movie. Because, once again, it's a movie about computers, about hacking, about sort of like decryption, mm-hmm. getting into big government sort of like systems, because this is in the 90s. So by the 90s, you know, from like War Games, this was made in the 80s, like we're away from like modems and just like calling up a system on a modem. You know, they felt that was safe because hardly anybody had a modem, you know, but even in War Games, they had a password. So that was like an easily like crackable thing. But this time, you know, in the 90s, like everything's encrypted. Mm-hmm. So you have this, you know, single encryption scheme that's on, you know, that's on these systems that are basically unhackable. And so Sneakers is about this ragtag group of ethical hackers.
Yep.
So what they do is banks hire them to crack into their system. And, you know, this security team exposes where the holes are.
Yeah. Basically, they're security experts as well.
Yeah.
They also do surveillance. Like I said, they test security systems.
Right.
They also do computer security.
Right.
It's Robert Redford's the leader. This team has an amazing group of actors. Do you want to get the list of actors who are on this team?
So Robert Redford is kind of the head of this like sort of ragtag group of vagabonds, I guess you would say.
Yeah, it's definitely a motley crew of motley computer crew. Nerds.
So Sidney Poitier plays Donald Kreese. David Strayhorn plays Irwin Whistler Emery, who also his character is blind, but the reason he's Whistler is because he's you know, he has amazing hearing. Mm-hmm. Then Dan Aykroyd plays Darren Mother Roskow. And then also River Phoenix, who just plays the you know, sort of general lackey kind of guy.
Yeah, he's sort of their junior intern, yeah.
Right, and so Dan is kind of like one of their, you know, they're all sort of like computer guys, but each of them have their sort of specialty, I guess you would say, into all the different systems. And
they're all kind of quirky, like Sidney Poitier is a no-nonsense ex-CIA guy. Dan Aykroyd's character is kind of like a conspiracy nut. There's a great running gag. Where
and he also plays like kind of the gadget, you know, sort of expert.
Yeah.
And Whistler is sort of the, you know, surveillance, you know, sort of, you know, because he knows, you know, how to listen security, like security system sort of expert. Yeah.
He's good with like being able to break codes that involve auditors, just like cracking safes and listening for tones and stuff like that. But yeah, there's a great little running gag where constantly when Dan Aykroyd's talking to Sidney Poitier, he's telling all these crazy conspiracy theories, and Sidney Poitier is just aghast at all these ridiculous things Dan Aykroyd's talking about.
Yeah, like they faked the moon landing. Yeah. And
cattle mutilations and, you know, alien abductions and who really killed JFK. And, and it's a pretty funny little gag.
He's definitely, you know, one of these like tinfoil hat wearing kind of guys, you know what
I mean? But it's also, it's not played over the top. It's all kind of just kind of, it's like friends hanging out, just kind of goofing around with each other, you know?
Yeah, he's sort of matter of fact. Yeah, like, you know, they faked the moon landing, you know? It was like, this, you know, Santa Monica. Or
yeah, you got friends like that, you kind of roll your eyes and laugh about it, you know? And
But I mean, and so the premise of the movie, though, is they get hired. Oh, also, Timothy Busfield, who plays like a supposed, you know, CIA agent.
He's the bad guy.
Or was it? Did they work for NSA or CIA? I can't remember.
They claimed to work for the NSA. Yeah.
NSA, yeah. And then also the other guy who was in it. What was his name? Eddie Jones, or
it was an actor I wasn't familiar with.
Stephen Tobolowsky. Anyway,
Stephen Tobolowsky's later on in the film. That's the guy from Groundhog's Day. You know, Ned Ryerson. You know,
right?
It's Ned the Head. You know, you don't know his Ned. You know that guy.
Ned Ryerson. Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyways, and then James Earl Jones plays the real NSA agent at the end. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, they get Timothy Busfield like. He, you know, who's also in Field of Dreams.
30-something. 30-something. For those of you who grew up in the 90s and watched adult dramas.
Revenge of the Nerds.
Revenge of the Nerds, yeah.
Which he probably doesn't want to talk about. But no, he plays like the... he kind of says he's a NSA agent.
Yeah.
And he basically kind of threatens Robert Redford's character's play. His name is Martin Bishop. And he says, you know, basically like... We know everybody. We have background on all of your crew.
We know you all have criminal records that you're hiding, basically.
Right, you're hiding, and we know your real name is Martin Bryce. And, you know, that kind of scares him. But they tell him, like, if you do this job for us, like, we'll exonerate your record and we'll clear your name. Yeah. You know.
And what they want him to get is there's this mathematician who's created a device that can be used to basically almost instantly decrypt any American encryption code.
Yeah, but they don't know that. They just do surveillance. Yeah. They steal the box. You know, they come up with this ruse to, like, sneak in and steal the box.
It's like a heist. Have you ever seen a heist film? It's like they plan the heist. They can, you know, it's fun. They have all the different working components. It's a team heist, basically.
And something happens unexpected. Like, somebody comes in the room and he has to, like, you know, fake being somebody else.
Yeah, it's very prototypical heist, but it's fun because it's Robert Redford who's a fountain of charisma.
Right. But it almost turned into like Fletch there for a second.
It is kind of Fletch the way he kind of bullshits his way through the end of it. It's because this movie's a lot lighter than the conversation. It's still got drama moments and the themes are similar.
Right.
But it's a lot more like jovial.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's not a comedy, but it's almost kind of light.
Yeah. It is. I mean, especially certain scenes are kind of put a smile on your face. You know, they're kind of fun. Like, oh, let's see them get out of this, you know. And he's telling the lady, like, oh, no, you know, I'm from, you know, his ex, you know, his wife hired me to come down here and to do this. And
he's banging bullshit stories about being a PI and doing investigations. Yeah. So anyway, they steal this thing.
They're fun. Then they steal the box. Yeah. They're gonna give it to the fake NSA guy.
And then they realize what it is.
No. They don't realize what it is. Yeah. They don't know what's in the box. They're like, we're just here to do the job, and then we're gonna get it gone. Yeah. Oh, no, they did figure out what it was that night.
Because Whistler starts messing with it to see what he does.
Right. And then they figure out that, like, they can decrypt, like, you know, the FAA and, you know, all these other places.
They can basically hack into all the banks and, you know, all the security databases. They can control, like, air traffic if they want to.
Right. And they're like, okay, so we got to get this out of here. So the next morning they go to rendezvous. They meet the guy. But then Sidney Poitier notices, like, he sees the front page of the paper.
The man who invented the box suddenly turned up dead.
And they're like, oh, crap. Okay, this might not be good. So he tells them to get back. They get back in the car. It was like kind of a car chase. And then they wound up with the box, and they kind of don't know what to do with it after that point, right?
Well, and Robert Redford basically ends up getting kidnapped at one point. They take the box from him, and a shadowy figure from his past. And we're not going to get into all the plot details, but a shadowy figure from Robert Redford's past takes the box from him.
Right.
And that shadowy figure is played by the great Ben Kingsley.
Yeah.
He was very fun. He's kind of a slimy computer nerd.
Yeah.
He's got, like, a ridiculous ponytail, and he wears really nice suits.
Yeah.
And he talks kind of a nerdy voice.
Yeah.
So it's fun to watch Kingsley and Robert Redford kind of verbally spar.
Right.
But yeah, so Kingsley ends up with the box, and he's someone from his past. Right. And
well, they were like college guys together, and that was like the intro scene. Mm-hmm. Was they were the first like really like computer hackers, and apparently Robert Redford's character was out getting pizza when all the rest of the guys got busted. And then so that's how he wound up, like, they all went to jail. And then so, you know, the story kind of goes, like, he tells them, like, Martin, like, this is going to, like, revolutionize. Like, it's going to level the playing field. Like, you know, we're not going to have, you know, the rich and the poor. Like, we're all going to, like, level everything out.
Yeah, Kingsley's character's whole plan with he uses this thing is basically just destroy the infrastructure.
Right.
You know, like, let's say, no more rich and poor.
Yeah.
No more us and them. I'll just start us back over at the beginning, like a good little like movie villain plot.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And
he really tries to get him on his side. Yeah, because he's really kind of.
It's because in a way, every good villain thinks they're right.
Yeah,
and his idea is pretty noble. He wants to eliminate the idea of classes in like social strata.
Right,
and so it's kind of noble, you know.
Right,
and he doesn't understand why Robert Redford's character wouldn't want to do that too, because they did something like that when they were kids.
Mm-hmm.
Like they were revolutionaries when they were kids,
right? Like they were kind of what do you call? Why can't I think at this time of day?
They were
such an idiot. Robin Hood.
They were sort of like computer Robin Hoods. Yeah,
I'm an idiot.
No, you're good, brother.
All right. It's late in the day. Sun's going down.
We started this much later than we normally do.
Okay.
So anyway, so
continuing.
Ben Kingsley ends up with the box, and he doesn't kill Robert Redford, but you know Robert Redford gets away. And so he has to get together with his buddies again and his security team, and they have to figure out a way to basically steal the box back from Ben Kingsley and his sleazy like criminal buddies.
Well, early on in the film, you meet Liz, who's played by Mary McDonnell, who you find out that like Martin Bishop and Liz used to be an item, and so she kind of gets roped into this crazy ragtag.
Yeah, her apartment becomes like their new base of operations when they have to hide.
Yeah, right.
Basically.
So she's like, oh, wow, okay, so now she's kind of involved. Huh? So they have to get into the building to steal back the box. So they do surveillance on the building, and they realize that there's one guy who has the office next to the bigger office, the corner office, where the actual box resides.
Yeah.
And that's when she kind of, the guy's office is the Stephen Tobolowsky.
Tobolowsky, yeah.
Yeah, who's Warner Brandis, I guess is his character name.
And again,
she kind of plays like, I'll take him out on a dinner date and
steal his card, steal his security card. Yeah. And again, Stephen Tobolowsky is Ned Ryerson from the great Groundhog Day. You know,
yeah.
He's kind of the nerdy insurance guy that Bill Murray keeps running into, where he's like, Ned Ryerson?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, he's that guy. So I know everyone knows right. who that is.
Because
yeah.
he plays like this nerdy sort of, you know, developer guy. You yeah. know what I mean? It's just like who you can't really have a straight conversation with, you know.
Yeah. So yeah, he's just a wonderful little character actor in that role. You yeah. know, he makes it sing a little more than it normally would.
So eventually, they all kind of get, you know, found out at the end.
Yeah. Well, they do their heist, and it goes kind of bad, and they have to escape, and hijinks ensue. Like Whistler, who's blind, is having to drive the escape van.
Yeah.
You know. One thing I love about the movie, and we're gonna gloss over the ending because it's not really that important.
No.
It doesn't end in violence. There's no big shootout. Robert Redford doesn't punch Ben Kingsley.
There is a final confrontation between him and Ben Kingsley, where they have a conversation where Ben is basically giving his plea, like, isn't this what we're after?
Yeah.
And he was like, no.
Is this what you always wanted?
Right.
But it doesn't even like them shooting each other or fighting.
Punching or like
it's basically two friends having an ideological conversation.
Right.
And it's refreshing.
Which is so funny because Ben is like, I could call the cops right now and have you just arrested, basically.
Yeah.
You know, and instead he's like, well, just give me back the box and I'll let you go. So he gives him back, like, the fake box, you know, and so they wound up getting away, but it's just like they did all that stuff and he still lets him go. Like that's his thing. He's like,
because it's still his friend,
right?
And it's not a movie about like who's stronger, who can shoot a gun better,
right?
It's about outsmarting and being quick witted and again, as much as the conversation was about isolation and loneliness,
okay,
Sneakers is very much about friends.
Okay, yeah.
And connections.
Yeah.
And Ben Kingsley just really wanted his friend back.
Right.
He forgave him for, you know, abandoning him to prison or whatever.
Right.
He just wanted his friend back. But, you know, Robert Redford already had a new family. He had these ragtag group of guys he worked with.
Right.
And so much of the movie is them hanging out, of them spending time together, you know, celebrating and having, you know, it's in a lot of ways it can be almost a hangout movie at times. It alternates between being a surveillance film to being a hangout movie to being a heist movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it's never really typical.
Mm-hmm.
So the other things about Sneakers, it's not a typical movie. It doesn't fit cleanly into any one box.
No, it's not really a comedy. It's not really a surveillance movie. It's not really a hacker movie.
Yeah.
It has a lot of those, you know, it has a lot of elements. I mean, there's elements of suspense. There's elements of drama. It's kind of a one all-encompassing movie that you can just watch as like kind of a caper kind of movie, you know, like what's going to happen next. I don't know what's going to happen
next.
And
it's enjoyable and it's engaging and you like the characters. You want to spend time with them. There's a scene where they're celebrating and they're all dancing.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes you smile.
Yeah.
Like it's such a, like a joyful little scene and it's such a great little movie. But again, it's about it's about the beauty of connection amongst friends,
right?
More so than anything else. So I think it makes a good pairing, not only because of the themes of hacking and surveillance with the conversation, but the fact that it's so diametrically opposed to the protagonist of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a guy who's isolated himself and found ruin by not having anyone around him, and these other people who have found family amongst themselves by choosing to rely on each other.
Yeah.
And that flip side of the coin is super interesting when watching them back to back.
Well, and you know that this, you know, box is important, but it kind of plays like a really back seat. You think it's really going to play like a really sort of front seat kind of movie, like when they steal it and people are chasing after them, and it's like, oh, this is what it's going to be. It's going to be like Hot Potato kind of thing.
Yeah, it's going to be like a Jerry Bruckheimer movie. It's going to be epic, and there's going to be huge stakes.
Yeah.
The stakes for this movie are very small.
No, it's not. It's almost like nobody else knows what's going on with
it. Yeah, it's so very minor, even though it could be very bombastic and like large, but the whole movie underplays it, and it's kind of delightful in that respect.
Yeah.
You know, it's just such a fun movie, and I had not seen this movie in literally 20 years.
Yeah.
And it just charmed me again.
Yeah, right.
It's just charming.
Yeah. I mean, Robert Redford, I mean, I think no matter what role that he's in, he could not play like not a charming guy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He would have a hard time playing like a villain or something like that. I mean, it's like you always want to be on his side. Yeah. And it's like they seem like, you know, the underdogs, you're like really rooting for them. You know what I mean?
Like Dan Aykroyd's super fun.
River
Phoenix is super likable. Sidney Poitier is like the coolest. You know, like he's such a you know, cool badass character.
But even the first like that, you know, right after they first steal the box and they have that party, you know, it's like you feel like you want to be there with them.
Yeah.
You feel like you want to be their friends and like hang out with them at that, you know, and celebrate with them.
Yeah, they're talking about what they're going to do with all their money and what they're going to do with the money they get from the score, and it's all very like relatable, normal things. And it just makes you immediately identify with them. Like, oh yeah, I would want something like that if I suddenly came into $20,000 or $30,000, you know? It's nothing overly epic or Hollywood about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just low-key and charming.
Right.
And I can't think of any other movies that really feel like Sneakers.
Well, I think, you know, a lot like War Games, it was very, like, of the time period for the type of security systems they have, the type of computer systems that they had. And, you know, all of it is really sort of plausible.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if you would have a madman that would want to, like, you know, overturn the whole system, you know, for this one box. But I can see that, like, you know, they're like, what country wouldn't want to have this box or whatever, you know, to be able to hack into all these different systems, like, just on a whim, to have all that ultimate power and control. But, I mean, I also think, you know, being in a, you know, sort of a computer profession, know that, like, once security, you know, once a big, you know, entity finds out that there are security holes, they close those holes pretty quickly. So there's no guarantee that the box is always going to work forever anyway.
Yeah.
But you still get the idea of, like, you know, this kind of power or whatever. And I think really the most charming, like you say, the most charming thing about the movie is just the characters and how they get along and how unique they are and how you know, they're not all the same typical, and they all have their unique, you know, and sort of weird, quirky, you know, ways about them, you know, and you're just like, you know, you and I would, you know, fit into that. And I think that's why it appealed to a lot of guys like us or you know, nerds. So go ahead and say it.
We are what we are.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, if you're a, you know, computer, you know, kind of guy or no, but I think that they still try to make it enjoyable for like any audiences. Like you didn't have to know, you know, what any of these computer systems are to really enjoy the movie.
Yeah. Like when I first saw it, I was like maybe 11.
Right.
Well, I didn't understand it, but I certainly enjoyed it.
Okay.
And I enjoyed it just as much now at, you know, 40.
All right.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, I think I saw it in high school, so I would have been, you know, right there, one of those kids watching it. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was a fun movie then. Like, we wanted to be those guys. Like, me and my friends were like, we envisioned, like, what some of those guys were doing. Like, yeah, we want to hack into systems. Or, like, some of my friends wanted to be ethical hackers and work for a team, work for a security.
I certainly have friends like that, too. Yeah, we were really into that, you know?
Yeah. So, yeah, a wonderful film. And, yeah, everything just winds up on a very good, clean note at the end.
And it's a happy movie. It really is.
I mean,
like,
James Earl Jones shows up. What are you guys doing?
Yeah. And even then, it's not played over the top, but it makes you smile and laugh to yourself a little bit. Yeah. It's just, again, it's delightful and charming.
Yeah. Not to mention another film that stars, like, the director, I guess. I mean, from Field of Dreams.
Yeah.
James Earl Jones, Timothy Busfield.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. So let's get on to the notes, shall we?
Please.
All right. I'm going to try to rush through this as much as possible because there's a lot of notes and we've already talked a lot. So I just want to kind of breeze through them. Some of these you may already know, Mr. Essery, since you're a movie buff yourself. Some of them that you may not. So Coppola has cited Michelangelo Antoni's blow up from 1966 as a key influence on his conceptualization of the conversation, such as surveillance versus participation and perception versus reality.
And I just want to stop for a second and explain really quickly what blow up is. It's about, it stars John Travolta.
No, That's the 1982 version. Oh. This was in 1966 was the original. The 82 is the remake.
I'm thinking of the De Palma version, yeah.
Yeah, the De Palma version is 1982.
I've never seen the original then. Never mind, that's embarrassing.
Michelangelo Antoni version.
I've got some homework to do, you guys.
So, wow, yeah. I got one over on Essie.
Yeah, I just immediately thought it was the remake. Wow.
Anyway, well, tell them about Blow Up anyway. Yeah. It's the same film. Yeah, this is a remake.
The remake by De Palma stars John Travolta as a sound engineer who's recording sound, ambient sound for a movie. And he hears what he thinks might be a crime happening. And it becomes kind of a paranoid thriller, and much like The Conversation. And it deals with the idea of sound and did you hear something or did you not hear something. It's a wonderful little paranoid thriller. I highly recommend it. I've never seen the original, embarrassingly enough, and I will definitely check it out now.
All right. Well, all right. So on the DVD commentary, I'll also say this. I don't know if this is in my notes. This movie came out. Let me make sure. Hold on. I got to read through. It is not in my notes.
It's okay. We can just.
I thought I was going to have it in my notes. I'll go ahead and add it now because I remember reading it. So I'll go ahead and say now. This movie came out right before or right after the whole Nixon Watergate scandal came out. So
you mean that they released the tape? They released the tapes for it in 1974.
Yes, and so basically that was one of the things that people were really loved the movie about because they really thought it because it dealt with surveillance and it dealt with. You know, recording private conversations.
It was
and stuff
a hot
like
topic
that.
At that time yeah, in the 70s, for sure. Topic. Yeah.
All right. Coppola says he was shocked to learn that the film utilized the same surveillance and wiretapping equipment that members of the Nixon administration used to spy on political opponents. The script was completed in the mid 60s. But yeah, I said, they had to get funding, wasn't until after the success of The Godfather. News of the Watergate story broke, but was released to theaters just a few months before. So it was before Nixon resigned.
Huh.
Yeah.
So that's it was amazingly like a, convenient. Yeah.
I know. It was like right at the right sort of weird time. The original cut was 4.5 hours long.
I can't imagine what you'd have. Because it's such a lean economical film. I can't imagine how it would be twice as long.
Apparently, there was a subplot of Harry dealing with his neighbors who complain about the building's plumbing problems because he owned the building. That was one of the reasons that he couldn't move out of the apartment is because he owned the building. Harry's kind of the other people in the building are unaware that he owns the building. They just complain about the owner. Other scenes featuring Harry consulting his lawyer, who is played by Abe Vigoda.
Huh.
About the apartment situation.
I'll tell you, that stuff sounds interesting, but man, right. I'm glad it was cut.
And then Harry convincing his teenage niece, plays by Mackenzie Phillips, not to run away from home.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds... It sounds
yeah,
like
there's all these other subplots.
It sounds like it would have been like, terrible.
Right, yeah, there's all these other subplots that like just didn't need to be there at all.
It's such a minimalist movie, anyway. Yeah,
I think they did a really good job of editing it down.
That sounds wild. I can't imagine what that version of the movie would have been like.
Coppola noted that Hackman had a very difficult time adapting himself to Harry Cole's character because it was so much unlike himself, because Hackman is an outgoing and approachable person who preferred casual clothes, and Call is a socially awkward who wore a raincoat and out of style glasses because he's wearing these really like kind of glasses from like the 1950s, but like it's really like 1972. Or
he
whatever.
Looks like a 1950s science professor.
Yeah, and it's like 1974. Yeah. Right? But Gene Hackman considers it one of his favorite performances.
It's an amazing performance.
Gene Hackman played former NSA agent who is a surveillance expert in Enemy of the State. Mm-hmm. So some people say that they're the same character. It's just an extension of Harry Call from The Conversation. And images from his character in his younger days are taken directly from The Conversation in Enemy of the State. So Hackman's characters are so similar. Yeah, but there's no evidence provided that Harry Call is the same character in Enemy of the State provided by makers of either film. And I think that might be due to some sort of like rights of the character and stuff like that.
Enemy of the State came out in 98, I believe.
Yeah, and with Will Smith.
Yeah, it's not a great film, but Hackman's great in it. And it is fun to watch it as like a pseudo sequel to The Conversation.
Gene Hackman did learn to play saxophone for the film.
Huh.
Gene Hackman's brother, Richard Hackman, played two roles in the film, the priest in the confessional and a security guard.
Neat.
All right. Yeah, and security guard in the building that he was trying to get into. I think it's the guy that he's like fighting as he's trying to get up the stairs. Harrison Ford's part was initially intended to be a small cameo written for, you know, just like an office assistant. But feeling that the character was one-dimensional, Ford decided to play him as gay.
Really?
So I don't know if you noticed that.
I didn't.
But the personally purchased the loud green silk suit for $900.
I think it shows a difference in culture because that did not come across to me at all in the film that he was gay.
I mean, it kind of did to me. And I mean, he's a assistant to the director. I mean, most assistants from the 70s, you would kind of think. And everything on his desk was very prim and proper.
I always think of like, because you know, metrosexuality is just such a common thing nowadays. It never occurred to me.
Right.
But I got to say, when I didn't mention support, Harrison Ford's really menacing in this, in his small role. Like, he's not intentionally menacing.
But in a very sort of polite way.
Yes.
Like, very sort of forceful and polite. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He never really hits you over the head. But yeah, I mean, I think that. But anyway, but they were so impressed with what Ford could bring to the role, that they actually gave the character a name instead of him just being office assistant. And, they, you know, created the kind of office environment to kind of reflect his character. They kind of expanded his character a little bit.
You can even tell at this point he was going to be a star.
Yeah.
He's magnetic.
Yeah.
You know, he's great.
Yeah. I mean, he really sold his role and didn't really oversell it. Yeah. Didn't really. I don't think there was a hint of overacting, no. You know, at all.
It's a great low key performance for Ford for sure.
Right. The blue Mercedes limousine that Cindy Williams was sitting in at the end of the film. This is a nice little side story. I love this story. Was won by Francis Ford Coppola on a bet with Paramount Pictures. Coppola had complained about the station wagon he shared with five other passengers during the filming of The Godfather. So studio executives told him that if The Godfather had grossed a certain amount, they would spring for a new car. So after The Godfather became the highest grossing film of all time, Coppola and George Lucas went to the dealer, went to the Mercedes dealer, picked it out, and told the salesman to bill it to Paramount Pictures. So I guess that they... you know, decided to just, you know, have it and use it in production.
That's
like when
awesome.
They need it. Yeah. So
well, it's like two true film weeks. Like they win a really nice car, immediately put it in a movie.
Yeah. When you're the director of like the highest grossing film of all time and win all the Academy Awards that, he did in 1973 or whatever. I mean, it's just like, man.
Yeah. For a while, Coppola could do whatever he wanted.
Yeah. So let's go through. Speaking of awards, let's go through all the nominations and the things that it won. On the Academy Awards, it was nominated for Best Picture, Best Original Screenplay, and Best Sound. The British Academy Awards, it was nominated for Best Direction, Best Actor by Gene Hackman, and Best Screenplay. It won for Best Editing and Best Soundtrack. For the Cannes Film Festival, it won the Grand Prix du Festival International du Film. And it was nominated for the Directors Guild of America for Directorial Achievement in Motion Pictures. The Golden Globes didn't win a Golden Globe, but it was nominated for Best Motion Picture for Drama, Best Director for a Motion Picture, Best Screenplay, Best Actor in a Motion Picture Drama. The National Board of Review, it won all four of the categories that it was in, Best Film, Best Director, Best Actor, Top 10 Films. And then the National Society of Film Critics, it won for Best Director. Now, you got to think, with the Academy Awards, it was nominated for three categories, Best Picture, Best Original Screenplay, and Best Sound, and didn't win any of them. So who did win those categories? Best Picture went to The Godfather Part II. So when you kind of compete with yourself.
Yeah.
All right. So Best Original Screenplay went to Chinatown.
That's another great film.
Another great film.
With a great script.
Great script. I mean, that's a detective story starring Jack Nicholson.
Yeah.
And another movie that will probably be on this show at some time. Yeah.
Maybe that and its sequel, maybe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then, yeah, what was it? The Two Jakes?
The Two Jakes, yeah.
All right. All right, and the best sound was for a movie called Earthquake, which a lot of people don't remember Earthquake, but for the time, they actually brought in big, huge subwoofers. And this is the first time that you had, like, subwoofers, like, in the movie theater to, like, make the sound of the earthquake. And people were just, like, you know, beside themselves to go rush to the theater to have this experience of sound.
Because back then, theaters didn't rumble like they do now. It was all, like, mono and kind of, like, tinny sound.
Yeah, they just had, like, one big horn back there for everything. And then you bring in these big, huge, monstrous subwoofers to make this rumble. And it's just, like... Like, oh my gosh.
Like, rush to the theaters to check it
out. I mean, this is like kind of like Jurassic Park, you know, type of stuff.
It was like DTS was or THX when it first came out. Yeah. Right.
And it really just was kind of a weird sort of a special effect for the movie. It didn't really, technically they didn't really have anything. It didn't really create another, like, kind of movie format like DTS or Dolby. It was just specifically for this film. But... you know, that's what won for best sound. So, but like I said, I think for the time period, I mean, barring, because you're not going to get that experience watching it on, you know, a DVD. Like if I go and watch this on Amazon Prime, I'm not going to get that experience of that rumble. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I think that for technically the sound of this film is absolutely amazing. The soundtrack, like the piano, like everything was just mixed really well. Yeah. You hear a lot of different things going on that you don't know where they come from. Yeah. It almost sounds like surround sound, even though it's not surround sound. I mean, it's just just incredibly mixed.
The sound mix is phenomenal. Yeah, it's unbelievably good.
Yeah, it really draws you in because there's not a lot of action to draw you in. And I think the sound really does that in this film. And really, I think that take away that special effect in the theater, I think it would have won. Golden Globes, it lost everything to Chinatown.
Well, Chinatown's a good movie.
Best Picture, Best Director, Best Screenplay, and Best Actor, like, all went to Chinatown.
Well, that was
the Golden Globes for Chinatown. They just cleaned up that year.
Yeah. Well, this is what a great year 74 was for movies, man.
Yeah. But you're going to be surprised. Well, I don't know. You may not be surprised.
Let's see.
Much the budget was for this film?
I don't know.
For the conversation?
Let's see.
1974?
$1 million.
1.6. You're not far. But box office, $4.4 million.
Nice.
I mean, yeah. I mean, that's quadrupling. That's almost quadrupling your original budget. I mean, that's pretty impressive.
That's a good size hit. Yeah.
Yeah. Roger Ebert gave it 4 stars.
I think he called it one of the best movies of all time.
Yeah, it's one of his top. It's one of his top movies for sure. He said this movie is a sadly observant character study about a man who has removed himself from life, thinks he can observe it dispassionately at an electronic remove, and finds that all of his barriers are worthless. Once again...
poetic.
Extremely. I mean, I don't think that I could have said it better, and I don't think that we would ever, ever come up with a sentence like that on the show.
Not off the fly, not off the cuff. Anyway, that's a beautifully crafted sentence.
I mean, I think that says it all right there. I don't think I can even add or take anything away from that.
Yeah.
Rotten Tomatoes also agrees. This is one of the highest scoring movies that we have reviewed on this show. What do you think?
I'm gonna guess 89%?
98%.
98%. Wow.
98%.
Swap those numbers. Yeah, 98%.
Critics score, 98%. And when I look through the thing, I mean, they all gave it, like, super high marks. So I don't even know where that 2%, like, really comes from. And then the audience score is 90%. So still really extremely up there.
If you're willing to give it a chance, it is super effective.
Man. So hopefully if you're listening by this, you've already seen the film and you know how good it is. So I don't have to tell you how good it is. So sneakers. Lawrence Lasker and Lawrence Parks worked on came up with the idea of sneakers while doing research for War Games. So they kind of already had this idea in the back of their head back in 1981.
Huh.
And took, you know, another 11 years to get it made. Okay, here's one of those weird meta, you know, sort of tie-ins that we have between these two movies that we conceptually could not fathom when we came up like, oh, let's do this movie and this movie. Yeah. And then somehow we find something that binds them together. Yeah. Through no fault of our own.
Yeah, well, we don't put a lot of thought into why we pair two movies. Sometimes it's just like, oh yeah, two surveillance films. There's surveillance in both these movies. Let's watch them.
Well, not only do they both take place, the main setting is in San Francisco,
which I didn't consider at all at first.
But yeah. Also the warehouse set in which the characters are having a party after getting the device is modeled on the same set of the warehouse party in The Conversation.
Yes, and if you look at them back to back, they are pretty similar.
Yeah. I mean, it is. They are in this like big sort of warehouse space, you know, and it's, I didn't even think about that. I think the one in sneakers looks more cozy.
Yes.
Like they have like sofas and
stuff. It goes
back
to the differences in the two films. Like one is more cold and distant, one is more comfortable and warm.
Yeah, but you can also see that it's a big sort of just like warehouse sort of tech shop kind of thing. Yeah. Once Robert Redford was attached to the picture, his name was used to recruit other members of the cast and crew, including the director, who had initial interest in the project but had always wanted to work with Redford. One of the reasons, okay, here's one of my complaints about the movie, is that River Phoenix is a great actor, and we should have had more movies starring him. Unfortunately, you know, his passing was so unfortunate. And, you know, in this movie, he doesn't really play like the smartest guy in the room.
No.
And he plays with a bunch of other really, really smart guys. Mm-hmm. And it really just didn't, you know, it wasn't one of those like, oh, River Phoenix, I love that guy.
He's a tertiary character. He's really kind of an afterthought in a lot of the scenes.
But one of the reasons River Phoenix, I found out, took the role of Carl was because he was so deep into the psychosis of his previous movie character, which was Mike Waters in My Own Private Idaho, that he wanted a low-stress money gig movie, and that's why he chose this role.
And that's perfectly cool. Sometimes you got to decompress and, you know,
kind of catch up and let things sort of happen instead of, you know, kind of being caught with, you know. But, yeah, sometimes actors just have to, like, oh, let me make a little bit of money before the end of the year, and then I'll choose my next role.
And he probably wanted to hang out with Dan Aykroyd and get to meet Sidney Poitier and work with Redford. And not work that hard. I mean, it's a pretty light role for him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It seemed pretty fun, and it seems something that he can kind of do. But also realizing now kind of, like, how he died.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of just sad.
Like, I wish he had been in more movies. And, like, again, like when we talked about with Brandon Lee, it's always sad when someone dies so young and you don't have more of them to enjoy.
Yeah. But also just because he wanted to go out and party. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, you know, it's really sad. RIP River Phoenix. The movie dealt with the impact of factoring a breakthrough on encryption, a reference to the RSA algorithm, the most popular public key encryption algorithm in use today. Professor Lynn Alderman, one of the co-inventors of the RSA algorithm, provided some technical guidance in this movie. So that's one of the reasons why it's so close in accuracy.
It feels very accurate for the time period.
Right, but the reason that he chose to work with this film is for giving his wife a chance to meet Robert Redford.
That's understandable.
I mean, he's a charming guy.
Yeah.
At one point in the project, Robinson received a visit from men claiming to be representatives from the Office of Naval Intelligence who indicated that for reasons of national security, the film could not include any references to, quote, a handheld device that can decode codes. Turns out it was just a prank, likely Aykroyd or Redford.
It sounds like an Aykroyd kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah. So Robinson being the director, that's who that was. That's who they're picking on. And then while picking through Dr. Brandis's, you know, trash, while they're, you know, trying to look through his stuff, Dan Aykroyd, mother, holds up a folded box of Captain Crunch. But this is basically a blatant, obvious reference to the phone breaker who found a whistle, a Captain Crunch whistle, who used to crack the long distance codes on phone systems back in the day. Because they could take the Captain Crunch whistle, they knew it blew at the same frequency as what a phone system needed to be able to make free long distance phone
calls.
That's
true. I didn't even think about that reference, but yeah.
All right.
Super nerdy, but cool. Yeah,
super, super nerdy. That's why the last four digits of my telephone number are 2600. But on to the point. Because it's 2600 hertz is the frequency. Stephen Tobolowsky, we were talking about him earlier. Ned Ryerson. He said, working on this film, it was one of the most spectacular casts he's ever been lucky enough to be a part of.
And he's been in a lot of great things. He's worked with a lot of people. Go look at his IMDb. He's been in tons of things.
Right. And the computer room of Cosmos, or Sir Ben Kingsley's office, is in the Playtronics building, the one that looks like a circular bench. Okay, that's actually a supercomputer from the time period. It's actually a Cray Y-MP, which is a multi-million dollar supercomputer that was one of the world's fastest computers at the time the movie was made.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, so that whole thing, it's not just like a weird artistic-looking bench in a room. They were really like admiring the supercomputer. That's what they're in there. And also, this is another nerdy reference, just like the Captain Crunch. The access code that was entered at the beginning of the movie ends in 1138. This is most likely in reference to George Lucas's first movie, THX 1138. The film's press kit was accompanied by a floppy disk containing a custom program explaining the movie. Parts of the program were quasi-encrypted, requiring the user to enter an easy guessable password to proceed. And, I mean, I think this is in the 90s. This is when, like, the press kit started really getting creative.
Yes.
You know what I mean? They're really trying to get attention, from the press, because they knew if they, you know, because this was a very competitive time for movies, that if they got the press sort of talking about it, then they can, you know, hopefully reap some freebie rewards or whatever. Yeah. So the budget for this movie was $35 million and box office $105.2.
It was a hit.
Yeah, very respectable.
Yeah.
Roger Ebert gave it 2.5 stars.
Out of four, again.
Out of four. 2.5, man.
Yeah.
He says one of the weaknesses of the movie is the way it pretends to be a techno thriller, when in fact it recycles much older traditions. There's not enough useful dialogue around to go around for a large team, and sometimes characters feel like they've been pushed on stage for obligatory scenes that are not really necessary.
He's not wrong, but it works for me.
Okay.
I mean that from a technical standpoint, he's not wrong, but it just does it work for you or does it not work for you? I enjoy it.
I mean, I think he's also sort of pigeonholing movie like a techno thriller. Yeah. Like, I think he's really going to the movie expecting a techno thriller.
Yes.
And he's getting something a little more light and, you know, that doesn't really sit well with
him. It's not a techno thriller. It's not really a thriller at all.
Right. So I just think this is where Ebert has, you know,
an expectation.
Different expectations than what it really is.
Yes.
He says the break-ins are directed with skill and imagination. It's sometimes an entertaining movie, but then.
Well, again, you know, the movie has endured. I think it's a really beloved film.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, critics aren't always right, you know.
Well, in Rotten Tomatoes, the scores are, you know, pretty even with the audience and critics score. So, it isn't one of these movies where critics like it, or, you know, where there's mismatched numbers. Rotten Tomatoes critics is 78, audience is 80. So it's like it's right there, basically.
Yeah. And those are still very good scores.
Yeah, those are extremely. I mean, that's still certified fresh, you guys.
Yeah.
In 2016, NBC was set to be developing a TV series based on the film, but no other information has been found following this announcement. So they probably abandoned all ideas about doing a sneakers type of...
Well, it's hard to find a cast that could really live up to the cast that they had, you know? Where are you going to find another Redford or another Sidney Poitier or another River Phoenix?
Well, there was also another similar series of a ragtag group of nerds saving the world that CBS did called Scorpion. And that also came out, I think, around 2016. And, you know, it's like if they did something, it was kind of like... Well, we're just copying them or whatever. Yeah. So I bet that's one of the reasons that they dropped the project.
Entirely possible.
Yeah, because if anybody has watched Scorpion, I think a lot of the same sort of themes on a larger scale sort of fit within sneakers. You have a lot of characters that also have their weird, odd, nerdy quirkiness that all sort of like kind of work together. You know, it is a little bit different. You have, you know, the different leader. You don't have a charismatic character. You have a more completely different character who knows technically everything, but like his social skills are really sort of, you know, behind. But I think that, you know, the idea of this, you know, sort of ethical hackers, you know, surveillance security people kind of, you know. Maybe already kind of played out on TV.
Yeah, I think that it's a concept that they got a lot of play for a few years, like a couple years ago. And I think it's kind of fallen dormant again in pop culture. But anyway, to wrap up, or start to wrap up, I'm going to ask you the question we always ask on video culture.
Yep.
If you were to rent these from the video store for a videotape double feature, would you keep them an extra day? Would you keep the conversation an extra day, or would you return it early?
I thought about this a lot when I was watching the film, and I think... One of the things that I didn't say when I was talking about the Academy Awards is I think that one of the other reasons why not only is it like was this movie up against movies like Chinatown and The Godfather Part II, but I also think because of the ending, it isn't one that leaves you feeling very satisfied and really leaving the theater like in a very sort of like, you know, gut-wrenching like, yes. And I think that really hurts the film. And I love the film and I'd love to watch it again. I don't know if I would watch it right away because it is a very sort of difficult study to, you know, and a very sort of suspense kind of thriller kind of movie.
Okay. Well, so what about sneakers for you?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I own it on Laserdisc.
It's a very fun movie for sure.
But no, I would say that watching the conversation... I will watch it again and again and again, and I will own this movie, and I will tell everybody about this movie, and I will say, you need to watch this movie. I don't know if it's one of those movies that's like, you know.
You need to give it some time to sit.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I did not think that I would be seriously really thinking about this particular movie multiple days later after I watched
it. That's what I keep telling you about 70s films. That's why I'm such a fan of 70s films. They have a way of warming into your mind and sticking with you.
Well, they do definitely have a little more sort of realistic grit to them. Mm. And I think, like I said, because, you know, it takes you to places like, you know, deep into, you know, Harry Call's psyche that are, you know, that... Are a little, you know, shaky a little bit. You know what I mean? Like I said, in the ending, you know, isn't one. It's like you have to decide. So it's almost like holding up a mirror to yourself about, well, what do you think happened? You know, it's like you have to decide what the ending is.
And just to say it simply, I love both these films for very different reasons. I think they're both fascinating and enjoyable. I would own both of them. I'm gonna own both of them. At some point, I will watch them again. How soon will I watch them again? I don't know, but I will return to both of them soon.
All right. Good enough. So, film recommendations. I'll go ahead with my recommendation first. I'm going to recommend a surveillance movie dealing with the Watergate scandal, starring Robert Redford, called All the President's Men.
An excellent choice.
And, you know, because he, you know, the Woodward and Bernstein... you know, I think he plays Bob Woodward, And, you know, it deals with a lot of, like, the same sort of thing, like the government conspiracy and, you know, the government agencies and the FBI and the CIA and all this other kind of stuff. So, and the surveillance techniques. But it's really hard to find a movie that's as unique as either one of these. But I think if you liked either one of these movies, you would enjoy All the President's Men.
I completely agree.
Right.
Especially Sneakers.
Right.
So for my recommendation, obviously I mentioned the De Palma film earlier.
Yep.
That's one I'd recommend checking out. But my true recommendation is a movie from the 80s directed by Michael Mann.
Okay.
Who did Heat. Okay. And he did Public Enemies, Black Hat, a movie about computer hackers.
Okay.
But he did this movie in the 1980s with James Caan called Thief.
Ah.
And it's about
seen this movie.
It's about a bank robber.
Okay.
And it's tonally it's very similar to The Conversation. It has to do with about you know, being isolated, paranoia.
Right.
And how you do a difficult job, a complex job, and you're afraid to let anyone close.
Mm.
And some of the framing of the shots is similar. The tone is similar.
Right.
But it deals with some of the heist aspects of Sneakers.
Okay.
So I think two of those elements of both films kind of blends them together to where if you wanted to watch a third film that felt similar to both in a way,
right,
you could slide in there as the third film in a triple feature, and it would not feel out of the ordinary.
Right.
And again, that's Michael Mann's Thief.
Right. All right. Well, we shall end it there. And I think that we can both recommend Blowout.
Oh, yeah. Blowout.
Which excellent. Blowout doesn't have anything to do with a hairstyle.
No. But yeah, check out De Palma's film. It's definitely one that influenced both these movies.
Yeah.
It's one of John Travolta's best films. Yeah, for sure.
And now we're both going to have to watch the 1966 version.
Yeah, I'm going to have to. I feel like I'm obligated to now. I've got homework, guys.
I know.
But, you know, it was a good episode, my friend. I enjoyed it.
All right. Well, thank you very much for listening to this week's podcast. I am Brian Acree.
And I'm Matthew Esri. Go watch some movies, guys. And remember, we are listening.
Thanks for checking out this episode of Video Culture. You can check us out on Twitter at Video Culture 2.
That's the number 2 for two guys talking about movies like Ryan and myself.
And you can also check us out on Facebook. Just search for Video Culture Podcast.
Also, be sure to stop by our official website, video-culture.com. There we have the entire show archives, as well as articles about film.
Yeah, so check us out. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, coming out with us, talk movies. Did you like the show? Do you hate the show? Do you like or hate the movies we talked about? Let us know. Come chat with us, and let's all watch movies together.
This is a world of hidden mics and two-way mirrors. A world where nothing is private.
You think we can do this?
Later in the week.
You think we can do this?
Harry Call is an expert. The best there is.
Let me tell you something about Harry Call. The best, bar none. I'll drink to that.
Best what?
The best bugger on the West Coast.
What about me?
He can bug anybody, anytime, anywhere.
Nobody knows how you did it, though, Harry. Caused a hell of a scandal, too.
Look, did you see him? The man with the hearing aid, like Charles. He's been following us all.
They're not people to him. Just voices.
Three people were murdered, that's all.
He doesn't know them, and they don't know him.
It had nothing to do with me. I mean, I just turned in the tapes.
Bless me, Father, for I've sinned. I've been involved in some work that I think will be used to hurt these two young people. No response. I'm not responsible.
You're not supposed to feel anything about it. You're just supposed to do it.
Be careful, Harry. You're just supposed to listen. Not look. Not feel. Not care.
Yes. Yes. How'd you get this phone number?
We prepare a full dossier on everyone.
It's terrific. The bugger got bugged, eh?
Do you have secrets, Harry? I know you do. Tell me about yourself. Your secrets.
I don't have any secrets.
Don't get involved in this, Mr. Cole. These tapes are dangerous.
Come on, Harry. Show and tell. How do you do it?
Why are you asking me all these questions?
Gene Hackman is Harry Call in The Conversation. There is nothing private about The Conversation. Listen.
My name is Harry Call. Can you hear me?